from the National Catholic Register. This is Register Radio, bringing light and clarity to the news and topics that affect your life.
The U.S. bishops met in a virtual assembly this week. The center of debate was Eucharistic coherence. Register Washington correspondent Loretta Brown covered the conference and gives us a wrap here on Register Radio. Then, the Supreme Court issued a decision this week in a long-awaited case, Fulton versus the City of Philadelphia. The High Court decided in a 9-0 ruling that Philadelphia can't force Catholic foster care agencies to place children in same-sex households. EWTN News analyst Andrea Picciotti Bayer provides us the story. I'm Jeanette DeMello, editor-in-chief of the National Catholic Register. I'm joined by my co-host Matthew Bunsen. Matthew, you and I both watched pretty much the whole bishops' conference. It was a really long few days. It was a bit painful to watch. The Zoom format was a bit difficult.
It was at times, I'm not sure the exact word, comical at times. at others, poignant, as bishops struggled to get themselves off of mute. It's worth pointing out that the final discussion on this document, on the Eucharist, the debate back and forth via Zoom, was about 3 hours.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah. I mean, it took them over an hour to approve an agenda, and that's usually, you know, 15 minutes or something. I mean, it was a very, very long meeting. You know, I think they accomplished what they needed to accomplish. The biggest question was how to respond to declining belief in the Eucharist and how to handle Catholics in public life like Joe Biden, who promote abortion and transgenderism in law contrary to what the church teaches. So this is what the discussion in large part centered around. There was much agreement and then there was much resistance to moving forward with a document. Ultimately, the bishops voted by simple majority to draft the document before the fall assembly. Loretta Brown, as I mentioned in my intro, Loretta Brown, the Register's national correspondent, covered this story. She watched the whole spring assembly meeting, and she's with Matthew now in Washington, D.C. To join us. Hi, Loretta.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So, Loretta, most church watchers knew this would be a contentious debate. Where did the biggest points of contention lie?
Yeah, so there was some background leading up here where, you know, there were some bishops who were concerned about the nature of drafting a document on, you know, touching on worthiness to receive the Eucharist in the context of our Catholic president, you know, still receiving communion but being very aggressively pro-abortion. So there were just some very heated back and forth, passionate, I should say, as well, about the scope of this document and about whether or not it would be aligned with maybe what the Vatican had in mind on this, because they did also receive a message from Cardinal Ladaria, the prefect of the Congregation of the Doctrine of the Faith, who talked about you know, just being cautious getting into this issue. And so there were some bishops who very much interpreted that and thought that meant that there needed to be a long dialogue about the issue and a dialogue with politicians, and that this should not be done virtually. This should be done in person. And that would wait until at least, you know, their November meeting, where likely they'll meet in person. And then there was a camp of bishops who were saying, you know, there is widespread confusion among the faithful on the Eucharist, just on basic things. And in addition, you know, it shouldn't be that much of a leap to sort of just outline canon law on this issue of worthiness to receive the Eucharist. And there was an emphasis, too, from those drafting the document of, we're not naming individuals. We're not even, you know, necessarily going fully into specific issues. We are just sort of restating church teaching on this. So there was just a lot of, you know, disagreement over the scope and the timing of the document. And so it certainly was something that, you know, many bishops felt very strongly on.
The issue of Cardinal Ladaria's letter was raised repeatedly by those who were trying to prevent really any discussion of this document. It was striking, though, right at the very beginning, wasn't it, that Archbishop Gomez also quoted a letter that he received from Archbishop Augustine de Noia, who's the adjunct secretary for the Congregation of the Doctrine of the Faith, saying, basically, we look forward to reviewing the draft you're going to send us. So there seem to be dueling letters from the CDF, but I guess it points to one of the questions in this, and that there seemed to be a lot of disagreement, not just on the whole topic, but even on what Cardinal Ladaria had to say in his now famous letter.
Well, certainly there were some, you know, bishops who made the case and seemed to just very firmly believe, like, we're not doing anything that is against what Cardinal Ladaria wrote, because what he cautioned was about, you know, don't hyper-focus on, you know, the one issue of abortion to the exclusion of others, other issues. And then he talked about the need for dialogue, which they're saying, you know, we can have dialogue. Some of them made the point of there's a continuous dialogue with pro-abortion Catholic politicians that is had when these issues arise and that has been had for quite a while. So they believe that kind of the conditions that Cardinal Ladaria discussed had already been met, whereas others just seem to very firmly think this warranted, you know, a lot more time and a lot more dialogue. And then there even was a little more heated disagreement of bishops implying that other bishops were just, or outright saying other bishops were just trying to cause delay. They just didn't want this.
Right, right. And I would say that Bishop Rhodes, whose committee is responsible for the drafting, really laid out right at the beginning that, you know, that this is in keeping with Ladaria said, but he clarified that there was confusion over what the document was going to be. You know, national policy, is this, you know, something that the bishops were going to have to follow as a national policy? And he said, you know, we used that word, and that was probably the incorrect term. And when Ladaria actually sent them this letter, it helped them to define better what they were putting forward, and they defined it better as a guidance and a teaching document. And I think that was a very important point that Bishop Rhodes made, and others supported that. I think you wrote about Archbishop Sample of Portland, who basically agreed with Rhodes and said, yeah, this is totally in keeping with what Cardinal Ladaria has said and what has been done in the past. So I think there was a lot, there continues to be just a lot of confusion over what exactly is being done. But ultimately, Loretta, and you write about this, and many bishops kind of pointed this out, really what is happening is they want to separate out from the discussion of the Eucharist any discussion about politicians or people in public life as a particular group who need to examine their conscience over receiving, you know? And that point was made several times. Take that part of the document out, and we'll all vote for it, pretty much, right?
Right. And I thought Bishop Rhodes, like, right at the outset, made the point of, like, the doctrine committee felt very strongly they needed to talk about worthiness to receive communion, even if it was just generally, when they talked about the issue of the Eucharist, because it is such a central teaching, you know, in the church, that if you're discussing the Eucharist, he was talking about how it was imperative to also just talk about worthiness to receive it as an element of that. So I think that proposal that you're talking about by some of these bishops to remove that element of it was not, you know, very favorably received. And there were also actually, you know, quite a few bishops who talked about the scandal of the time we're living in with, you know, President Biden, who goes to mass and talks about his Catholic faith, but is very aggressively pro-abortion. And I thought Archbishop Naumann, the pro-life committee chair, made a very just compelling argument about how this is a scandal, and this is something that, you know, these politicians, they're not acting with integrity. And he wanted to call them to integrity. And I mean, he wasn't even necessarily talking about what needed to be in the document, but he was saying this is a crucial time because this is what the faithful are seeing, and it is confusing. And other bishops specifically said, yes, like, laity have come up to me confused about the situation with the president. So, like, do we need to, you know, specifically name him and make some proclamation about him? I mean, they can't even, they don't even really have the authority, the scope at this time, it sounds like, to do that. But at the same time, just given that that is the situation in the U.S., that is an example that the laity are seeing, many of them felt like this is something that we can be clear on. We can be clear on, you know, who should be presenting themselves for communion.
Right. You know, and I did want to point out those who were in opposition to this document moving forward are some rather consistent voices. I mean, we've heard them already. Cardinal Supich of Chicago, Cardinal Wilton Gregory of Washington, D.C., who actually oversees the diocese, archdiocese where President Biden resides. There were others, though, who have not spoken. Oh, Bishop McElroy of San Diego is another who,
by far, yeah,
right, who said basically this is weaponizing the Eucharist, and so. But there were others who aren't, who haven't been so vocal about that. Archbishop Michael Jacobs of Dubuque, Iowa. You know, he just felt like the document wasn't going to accomplish anything. He said, why should we write documents? We've already done a lot of documents. What's needed is really for bishops and pastors in their own places to really reinvigorate the laity. So there, not everybody who disagreed with the document moving forward had those concerns over, let's say, weaponizing. I just want to be fair to some of those who spoke and just said they didn't feel like this was the right move or the right way of going about it. But I also want to bring forward some voices who, again, aren't often heard, who really supported moving forward. Bishop Donald DeGroote of Sioux Falls, South Dakota, a place we don't hear much from, he said, you know, laity have been very scandalized. And they have come to him asking for direction. And his fear was that if the bishops didn't speak now, that they were losing an important moment. And then Bishop Hying of Madison, Wisconsin, he made the point that, look, they are a small diocese, a rural diocese, and they depend on what the conference does. So a document for him would be very valuable because they don't always have the resources to put out things like that themselves. So anyway, that's a big overview, I think, of where the bishops fell. Where will this go from here, Loretta?
Well, it's interesting. I think there will be a document that, you know, talks about church teaching, hopefully in a very like rich, deep way, as some of the bishops, you know, said. But I think it might be a little disappointing because with all these discussions and debates, it may be a little watered down. I've seen concerns that it's just going to be sort of a watered down restatement, and that is where I think Archbishop Jackals, I think you mentioned his point, does kind of land a little bit of like we are in a place now where there's enough scandal over the worthiness to receive communion that at a parish level, you know, this needs to be addressed. And
right.
I mean, the Eucharistic Revival Initiative, these different things the bishops are doing, hopefully this bears some fruit and this, you know, this document can help, you know, some to sort of just learn more about this issue. So I think that's the hope.
And
right.
It connects so well, too, to the plan for Eucharistic revival that was also presented at the conference, where the two really need to go hand in hand.
Right. And we had David Spezia on last week on Register Radio. He's head of the evangelization office there at the USCCB. And so, yeah, he gave us a great preview of what that initiative will hold. Loretta, to your point, you know, when the bishops come to the assembly in November, their general assembly, you know, and they vote on the document that has been drafted, I'm sure there's going to be a lot more discussion. And like you said, it could be a watered down document that doesn't satisfy anyone. So let's see what happens. Thanks so much for your attention this week. It was a bit of a grueling week.
Yeah, thanks. It was interesting, exciting. But yeah, it's always interesting at the USCCB conferences.
On to November in person with the bishops.
Yes.
Exactly. When we come back, we turn to EWTN News legal analyst Andrea Picciotti-Bayer.
In these uncertain times, Catholics depend on EWTN's National Catholic Register. The Register is so much more than a newspaper. It's your faith, your life, your source of information and spiritual resources. The Register is uplifting, redemptive journalism, interviews with Catholic leaders and newsmakers, liturgical coverage, health, financial, and political topics, and analysis of the key issues you care most about. EWTN's National Catholic Register covers every aspect of the Catholic faith that impacts your world. To get 6 free issues, order online at ncregister.com/radio or call 800-421-3230 and mention code radio. That's ncregister.com/radio or call 800-421-3230 and mention code radio. The National Catholic Register. Read faithfully.
There was no single event. It was more gradual. You know, eventually you just don't go one Sunday and then you don't go 2 Sundays in a row. Then went through a divorce and ended up being a single parent. If I didn't have church or God, I would be back at that lonely stage, that trouble stage. Whenever you get anxious and worry about things, you just know that Jesus has it under control.
If you've been away from the Catholic Church for any reason, visit CatholicsComeHome.org.
Let's return to Register Radio on EWTN.
Welcome back. I'm Jeanette DeMello, Editor-in-Chief of the National Catholic Register, and I'm joined by my co-host here on Register Radio, Matthew Bunsen. We've all been waiting for this decision. The Supreme Court on June 17th decided in favor of Catholic Social Services in its lawsuit against the City of Philadelphia, ruling that the city violated the group's free exercise of religion. The judgment was 9-0. That unanimity is not something you see much, especially on issues that deal with same-sex couples and religious liberty. To that point, we have Andrea Pachotti Bayer, who is EWTN News' legal analyst, to discuss the issues surrounding this Fulton versus City of Philadelphia decision. Welcome, Andrea.
Thanks, Jeanette, for having me. Thanks, Matthew, too.
So, Andrea, you have written for the Register that this is a vindication of religious liberty. It's a win for religious liberty. That's a wonderful thing. Was this what was expected?
Well, it's a huge win. And having been tracking this case and listening to the oral arguments last November, I did expect a victory. What I didn't expect is that it would be such an overwhelming victory. Like you said before, a 9-0 judgment where this court, which has people on very different ends of the political spectrum, came together and said the Constitution was violated and the free exercise rights of the Archdiocese foster care placement was violated by the city's action. So it's like I say, a huge religious freedom victory.
Now, you wrote, and you made a point to me as you advise us in some of our editing and framing of these issues, which is very much appreciated by our legal analysts, you made the point to me that it's a unanimous judgment. It's not necessarily a unanimous decision as a whole, and that's because they have issued different opinions. What's the significance of that, and what are some of these nuances?
Well, in general, we should know that the decision itself that was authored by Chief Justice John Roberts is the decision of the court, and that becomes precedent that not only the Supreme Court is going to look to, but the lower courts of appeals and district courts must follow. And if government actors are paying any attention, they'll make sure to follow as well. As far as the difference between an opinion and a judgment, what's very interesting in this case is that three justices, Justice Samuel Alito, Justice Clarence Thomas, and Neil Gorsuch, agreed with the outcome, but they disagreed with the reasoning. And they offered, through Justice Alito, a very lengthy 77-page concurring opinion where they would have ended up at the same place, which is concluding that Philadelphia had violated the First Amendment, but they would have done so in a different fashion. So at the end of the day, all that matters is that we've got the court recognizing and vindicating the First Amendment, but there's a different way that they would have gone towards it. What's very helpful in Justice Alito's concurring opinion is it really does lay a path forward for future cases that more squarely address some of the issues that the majority of the justices didn't think that they needed to address in the Philadelphia case.
So in order to get this majority, basically a victory, the 9-0, Roberts actually really kind of herded the group quite well. How did he get this to be a unanimous decision? I mean, what did he have to do to narrow it enough that even more liberal justices voted for it, basically?
You know, there's a tendency, especially among court watchers, to have kind of palace intrigue and to try to figure out what was going on. How was the sausage being made?
All right, put me in my place. That's right.
No. It's a great temptation. One thing that's very important is that the court has had a tradition of respecting the internal decision-making of the body. And that means that justices don't go out there and say, well, you know, we were this close and someone decided that they had a problem. They don't do that. If what is out there is a debate on the analysis in the opinions. Mm-hmm. What I do think is really important and significant about the Fulton case is that it continues to show consensus by the court, including more left-leaning justices, on these fundamental rights, even when they're to the benefit of conservative Americans. And so it kind of pulls us back from thinking of the court as a political body, mm-hmm. and more as what it's envisioned to be, which is an interpreter and defender of the Constitution.
But there seems to be almost a reluctance to accept this as a big win in certain quarters. Is it partly because there's a longer-term goal, or is it just a real concern that this type of a victory won't be lasting?
Well, you know, the same thing happened last year, if you remember, when the Little Sisters of the Poor received yet another victory in their search for an exemption from the Affordable Care Act's contraceptive mandate. There were lots of people that were diminishing the scope of the victory. As it's turned out, we're a year in, and they're still able to benefit from that exemption that was crafted by the Department of Health and Human Services. I think that we need to celebrate these victories and see the importance of the precedent that's set down. There is a real benefit in the lengthy concurrences, only because the court in its history, especially in religious freedom cases, has looked to some of these concurring opinions for how to resolve the next case that comes. So I think people are anxious, and there's a lot of folks that are taking hot takes as what Fulton's reach will be. It's probably more prudent to steady ourselves and raise a glass, because this is a great, great win, and especially for the Catholic Agency and the foster care mothers that brought the case in the first place, to defend their ability to serve consistent with their beliefs.
Andrea, you did provide an amicus brief for this case. You have written about those who were involved, basically those who were vouching for the services provided by Catholic charities. What did they have to say? Why were they so insistent that this was worthwhile?
Well, it's incredible. The number of people who have been touched by Catholic-run foster care and adoption agencies is heartwarming, and not just in Philadelphia, but across the country. And the brief that I submitted to the Court of Appeals and then again to the Supreme Court gathered stories of former foster care children and foster and adopted parents who really shared how their relationship with Catholic-run agencies made a success in the foster care or adoption program. And one of our dear friends, Elizabeth Kirk, who also wrote in the Register, she herself is an adopted and foster mother, and she brings that personal experience to her work. And the briefs that we submitted to the courts really are trying to focus these justices and lower court judges on the real world impact of their decisions, and really showing how when you keep all doors open, children who have suffered incredible abuse and neglect can thrive once again.
So I just want to point to two pieces that we've run, commentaries at ncregister.com, that are important for our listeners to get a full understanding of what's going on here. One of them is, of course, by Andrea Picciotti Bayer, who's joining us right now. It's titled, Supreme Court Unanimous Fulton Ruling Vindicates Religious Freedom. And the second one is, Supreme Court Unanimously Protects Catholic Foster Care Agency, by Elizabeth Kirk. Both are very important reads. I think it helps us understand what issues are in play here, and where this these kind of decisions will play out perhaps in future cases. But as Andrea said, and I think it's important to recognize that this is indeed a victory, especially for those in Philadelphia who have benefited from these foster care services. Andrea, as always, I appreciate your analysis and the advice that you give us at ncregister.com.
Well, it's my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me on.
Remember, for more news, analysis, and commentary, check out the National Catholic Register online at ncregister.com. Thanks for joining us here on Register Radio on EWTN. For Matthew Bunsen and our producer, Jeff Burson, I'm Jeanette DeMello. Until next week, God bless you.